For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It's 10 past 8. The morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We are going to be exploring today, exploration, and in particular, a very interesting and not well understood chapter when it comes to the annals of world exploration, specifically exploration of the top of the world, the Arctic region of the globe, and the way in which exploration of this inhospitable region of the planet was undertaken in the late 19th into the early 20th century, utilizing the then modern technology of the airship and the aeroplane. And the story that is explored in this book, Realm of Ice and Sky, is the story of several intrepid explorers who were courageous and maybe to some extent even foolhardy in their determination to reach the North Pole and their determination to do so in groundbreaking ways never attempted before. That is, to reach the North Pole by air. So this is the story not only of explorers that we have perhaps heard of, like the great Norwegian Roald Amundsen, but also the story of such largely forgotten figures as the amazing explorer Walter Wellman, or the all but unknown or completely forgotten Italian explorer Umberto Nobile. All of this told in this extraordinary book, Realm of Ice and Sky, Triumph, Tragedy, and History's Greatest Arctic Rescue, published by St. Martin's Press. The author, Buddy Levy, is already responsible for a host of amazing books, and just about all of them are around this theme of exploration. And many of his books, although not all of them, have to do with this exceptionally dangerous part of the world. Buddy Levy, we welcome you to the morning show.
Greg, it's a great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I am so excited to talk with you. I absolutely loved your book, and I learned so much about it. We have lots of ground to cover, but I do just want to ask you, you have written so much about exploration and the courage of explorers and often the tragedy that befalls them. Does anything in particular draw you to these kind of stories? What about them do you find especially compelling?
Yeah, I suppose human survival is among them. I grew up in a ski town in Idaho, and my father was a Nordic skier, and he introduced me to Scandinavian explorers when I was a boy. And also, I read, of course, a lot of Jack London and Hemingway. And so I was just, from an early age, kind of drawn to man versus nature stories. And, you know, later in my career, as I started really getting a foothold, and these stories are just so compelling. And I was always intrigued by what drew men, mostly men at the time, to go to the far reaches of the globe and to places that no one had ever been before. And so all of that exploration, adventure, survival were the primary drivers of my interest in the genre.
There is a very special kind of drama, isn't there? I remember as a youngster in the Childcraft that we had at home, which was kind of the children's version of World Book Encyclopedia, I remember reading the story of Robert Falcon Scott and his ill-fated attempt to reach the South Pole. And he ended up falling second to Roald Amundsen, and then tragically he and all of his party perished before they could return home. And I lost count of the number of times that I read and reread that story. It just sort of speaks to what it means to a certain kind of human being that finds themselves drawn to those kind of quests. How did you find out about this particular bundle of intriguing stories of explorers trying to reach the North Pole by air. I suppose on some level you probably have known about it for a long time, given the business you're in, but did anything in particular kind of galvanize your interest in exploring this further?
Yeah, great question. In 2003, I was traveling in Greenland writing journalism about this adventure race, and a Norwegian woman gave me a book by Fridtjof Nansen, was actually Amundsen's protege, called The First Crossing of Greenland. And I read that book voraciously, and I just became absolutely mesmerized with the high Arctic North and the icebergs, the ice flows, the polar winds. And I started digging in, and that's when I found the story about the Greeley expedition that was my book, Labyrinth of Ice. And once I went down the ice rabbit hole, I suppose, I just kept bumping into story after story that were mesmerizing and compelling and dramatic. And along the way, I came across an article about this airship expedition, but I was writing another book, Empire of Ice and Stone, about the Canadian Arctic expedition. And so I just filed it away. And when I finished Empire of Ice and Stone, I came back to that and I thought, wait, these guys tried to fly dirigibles to the North Pole. What could possibly go wrong?
Well, and one of the things that is interesting is to think about, first of all, the historical context of all the previous attempts that had been made to reach the North Pole by more standard means, by dog sled, attempts which had failed, and some of them tragically so. And of course, one of the men that you talk about at great length in your book, American Walter Wellman, was very well acquainted with those previous and more, in a sense, standard attempts at reaching the North Pole. Tell us more about Walter Wellman's background as an explorer, and then what seems to have inspired him to make the attempt in this revolutionary new way.
Sure. Walter Wellman's just an intriguing figure. He's so interesting. At the time the book begins, Wellman was a really famous American journalist who was hobnobbing with Theodore Roosevelt, Andrew Carnegie, J.P. Morgan. I mean, he was writing about captains of industry and the American politics, and he was quite well known. He ended up having, I mean, what an interesting guy. He had a side hustle as an Arctic explorer. What he wanted to do was do Arctic exploration and then write about it. And this is the time of all of the big newspaper competitions happening at the turn of the century and even a little bit before the late 1800s. And so Wellman made a number of forays to Franz Josef Land, to Svalbard, north of Norway, and tried in the traditional, as you say, dog sled method. And he realized after nearly dying, shattering his leg, it almost had to be amputated. And he came back, and at the same time, he was writing articles about, I mean, the Wright brothers were trying to fly airplanes at Kitty Hawk. The dirigible was in its fledgling stages. And Wellman had this epiphany after he was marooned on this island for months, recovering from this broken leg. And he thought, if anyone is ever going to get to the North Pole, and at the time, the North Pole had not been reached, they're going to do so by air. It was kind of a light bulb moment. And he started studying the airship development in France, which again was in its fledgling stages. And one of the things I love about this story is that it's unclear at the beginning of this book in history whether the airplane or the airship would eventually have supremacy of the skies for commercial travel. And so Wellman decides he's going to be the guy who makes it to the North Pole first. And men like Roald Amundsen, who you referenced, and Frederick Cook, and a number of other men were vying for the North Pole at the same time. So there's also this compelling kind of race aspect to this story, like who's going to get there first and achieve polar fame and immortality. And Wellman wants it to be him so he can write about it, write books, have lecture tours, and be rich and famous.
Right. And towards that last point, I want to be sure that we highlight this. You write in your book's prologue, Wellman, who wanted to be the first to not only reach the North Pole, but also broadcast his achievement to the world in real time. And you go on to explain what he had done in order to sort of pave the way or lay the groundwork for this dramatic broadcast, if we want to call that, to occur in the immediate wake of his triumph.
Exactly. There's a lot of technology that's on the cutting edge in this book, and Wellman had been studying the work of the Italian Marconi, and whose radio wireless telegraphy had just recently been developed. So Wellman gets the idea and actually sets up radio communication from Tromsø, Norway, the mainland Norway, sets up a station on Danes Island in northern Svalbard, and then the plan is to have another wireless station installed aboard the airship America. And Wellman, in fact, sends the first wireless telegram from the Arctic to Theodore Roosevelt. It goes all the way from the far reaches of halfway between Norway and the North Pole to Washington, D.C. And you know, Wellman was ahead of his time. This technology could send cryptic short messages. His plan, but he prefigured real-time radio communication during expeditions by many years, and it was remarkable that he was even bold enough to think that it might work. Now, there ended up being some problems with the communication, as you might guess, but just the fact that he was brazen enough to try and planned it out was really something.
Right, and is part of the Wellman story that he thought about and to some extent perhaps even seriously pursued other possibilities in terms of modern technology, the cutting edge in a lot of different ways, including, you tell us, a newly invented lightweight aluminum boat for crossing open seas in sea ice, special kinds of ultra-concentrated foods for light, high-calorie rations, and even tested gas-powered motor sledges that would replace the dog sleds of days before. And, of course, most audacious of all, this idea of actually flying to the North Pole in an airship. You tell us that Wellman could see what many others could not. The world was changing. Now it seems kind of crazy for somebody that early in the century to be attempting something like that. What was it, a crazy notion right from the start of trying to reach the North Pole via a dirigible?
Well, lots of journalists said so. I mean, many called Wellman's first attempts toward the North Pole as a suicide mission. And in fact, you know, if you think about strapping a gas-powered motor onto a flammable hydrogen balloon, essentially filled with 274,000 cubic feet of hydrogen, there's some problems that could occur. But Wellman was, and also he hadn't really tested these. They had been tested a little bit, but in terms of putting a motor on one, balloon technology was pretty advanced, but no one had tried to put a motor on one and steer one, and much less at the far northern reaches of the world. So, yeah, it was pretty crazy. And but Wellman, you know, these men were brave. They were pioneers. I liken them to, I mean, they're called aeronauts, but I liken them to our astronauts, you know? I mean, it takes someone to have that chutzpah to decide, I'm going to be the one. And so, you know, he decided, and there were lots of safeguards and checks, and he had these tethers that could be lowered from the airship to kind of potentially keep, there were like brakes that would grab the ice and keep him at a certain elevation or altitude. But it was certainly untried. And there were, you know, every time he got in this Airship America and flew, there was a very real possibility that he and his crew members were not coming home.
Right. We're speaking with Buddy Levy, author of the book Realm of Ice and Sky, Triumph, Tragedy, and History's Greatest Arctic Rescue. We are talking about the early days of Arctic exploration in which the tried and true methods of the past, unsuccessful in terms of reaching the North Pole via dog sled and, I mean, overland, were supplanted by this new possibility of reaching the North Pole either by airship or by aeroplane. And American Walter Wellman was not the only one who undertook such a possibility. The great Norwegian explorer Roald Amundsen, the first human being to successfully reach the South Pole, was also taken up by this possibility. In fact, you tell us that the opening of the second section of your book, at nearly the same time Walter Wellman was hanging up his aviator cap and goggles, that is, having sort of surrendered to defeat, Norwegian explorer Roald Amundsen began taking flying lessons. In some ways, that story is every bit as amazing as Walter Wellman's, that someone who had already achieved so much as an explorer was willing at a relatively advanced age to undertake a possibility like this.
Yeah, Amundsen is my hero in many ways. I call him the GOAT, you know, the greatest of all time in Arctic exploration. And as you mentioned, he had beaten Scott to the South Pole. He was first through the Northwest Passage. And he was right on the verge of retirement, really, when he was visited by another American named Lincoln Ellsworth. And this man convinced Amundsen that Ellsworth had a lot of money, and he inherited a bunch from his father, and he convinced Amundsen to try to fly to the North Pole. And the initial efforts, they tried in airplanes, and there's a chapter that's incredibly harrowing where they get stranded on the ice hundreds of miles north of Svalbard and it's like a month-long ordeal, and Amundsen and Ellsworth and a number of other men have to carve out their own runway, but he ends up just deciding after the attempt in airplanes that Wellman, who had predicted aerial flight would conquer the North Pole eventually in 1893, and Amundsen finally concedes that he's probably right, and at that point he conspires with Italian airship designer Umberto Nobile to attempt flying in a much more advanced airship. This is in 1926, nearly 20 years after Wellman, that the airship is going to be the way to make it. And then there's this, as you say, it's a whole section about Amundsen and his attempts, which are dramatic in their own right. And also, it's really fascinating because it becomes a race for the North Pole. And because a number of men, including Richard Byrd, are trying to get there by airplane, and then a number of men are trying to get there by airship. So you have this amazing sporting event, the journalists call it, but the explorers didn't consider it a sporting event so much as, you know, an exploration, a discovery, and science. And so it's just a really, really great, competition to see who's going to get there first.
Right. And, of course, what is especially fascinating about this undertaking with Roald Amundsen from Norway and Umberto Nobile from Italy, you call this an unlikely pairing, a wedding of convenience, an arranged marriage. And it ends up being a partnership that very quickly turns sour. Just say a word about kind of the volatility of this relationship between the Norwegian explorer and this Italian airship designer, and why, in a sense, their partnership was doomed from the start.
Right. Well, Nobile and Amundsen both have massive egos, Nobile is not an explorer. He's an airship designer and a military man under Benito Mussolini. And so they both look at each other as, Amundsen looks at Nobile as basically a pilot who is flying an airship. But Amundsen has led numerous expeditions, and so he's the expedition leader. And Nobile looks at him as kind of a paying passenger. And so from the very beginning, they don't have a great deal of respect for one another, which is unfortunate because what they're trying is really historical in scope. And there's also national pride involved, you know, that you've got this international expedition, but both want the laurels and both want them for their country. And Amundsen names the airship Norge for Norway, even though it was built by an Italian in Italy. And so there's just all sorts of infighting from the beginning, and it really escalates after the expedition when each are vying for the spoils of the amazing thing they've just accomplished, and it devolves into something rather unsavory. But I should say that later in part three, Amundsen ends up doing something really magnanimous, which is to try to go help and save Umberto Nobile from his disastrous own trip in 1928. And so there's a really remarkable kind of Hollywood ending to this whole thing that I won't divulge, but will say that it's quite dramatic.
Absolutely. In our closing couple of minutes, I want to give you a chance to talk about something that you touch on beyond these amazing tales of exploration and success and failure and so on, and that is in the postscript of the book, which is titled Renaissance of the Airship, in which you tell us at one point, a brave new airship era is upon us. Tell our listeners what you're talking about there.
Sure. I would say to your listeners, start looking up, because what I stumbled upon as I was writing the proposal for this book is that a number of entities around the world, including Sergey Brin, the Google founder, and some American firms, are now building airships that are going to be in the skies. In addition to the Goodyear blimp, there are going to be super technologically advanced airships that are being used for not only luxury travel, but also humanitarian aid, because they can hover over places that have no cell coverage. They can drop off thousands and thousands of pounds. These are helium inflated, so not dangerous and flammable. The most technologically advanced airships that have ever been created are currently being manufactured, tested in California, and they're going to be in 25 and 26. You're going to start seeing these things. They're 400 feet long. They're just stunning. And I was really amazed to come across this, that this is happening, because it brought everything full circle. That sort of justifies that the airship is a safe and viable mode of both transportation and cargo payload delivery. So it's really cool. That was just something that I stumbled upon, and my mouth was agape, and I was like, you've got to be kidding me. Because everyone remembers the Hindenburg, and that kind of ended the airship until now. Mm.
Well, that's just one small facet of an extraordinary story that you tell so brilliantly in your new book, Realm of Ice and Sky, Triumph, Tragedy, and History's Greatest Arctic Rescue, published by St. Martin's Press, the author, Buddy Levy. Buddy Levy, congratulations on an absolutely marvelous book, and thank you for being my morning show guest today. I was very privileged to speak with you.
Thank you, Greg. Great talking to you.
And I am so happy that we can now extend our conversation a bit further with Buddy Levy, talking about his book, Realm of Ice and Sky, Triumph, Tragedy, and History's Greatest Arctic Rescue. It's an opportunity for us to delve a little deeper into a couple of matters which we could only sort of glancingly discuss in our first conversation, And this book, again, by the way, is published by St. Martin's Press. Buddy Levy, thank you for agreeing to a follow-up conversation. I really appreciate it.
Greg, it's my pleasure. Glad to be here again.
One thing that we did not get to talk about the first time is the matter of money and the fact that these various explorations of the Arctic region, and for that matter, explorations of Antarctica as well, were costly. And there almost always needed to be a backer or a series of backers, financial backers, willing to pony up with probably considerable funds in order to make some of these expeditions possible. I'm curious, first of all, the kind of people who typically would write the checks to help underwrite these expeditions, and typically, why would they do so? What would they gain from somebody, for instance, successfully reaching the North Pole? I guess I'm asking as much as anything about sort of the relationship between some of these explorers and their financial backers.
Well, great question. Yeah, you're right. These expeditions in the turn of the 20th century, you know, costs on the order of many hundreds of thousands of dollars in those days' money, which was many millions of dollars in today's currency. And there were a number of avenues for backing, all of which were crucial and all of which were difficult to obtain. So in the case of Wellman and the earlier expeditions, there are a number of possibilities at play, and they had different rationale. And I'll go back, you know, to the newspaper man James Gordon Bennett, who already in the 1880s was financing expeditions. There's a famous one called the Jeannette, where the idea being that you were basically buying your own scoop to these stories. So newspaper publishers and owners would pony up great deals of money and embed journalists on the expeditions in the hopes that some of them would survive, or the records would survive, and they would get the story ahead of the other rival newspapers. Now, this was the case with Walter Wellman as well, because he worked for the Chicago Record Herald, and they, the publisher of that paper, put up a couple of $100,000 for his expeditions to the North Pole. Wellman had silent backers as well in great famous captains of industry in the United States, including Andrew Carnegie, J.P. Morgan, and even Theodore Roosevelt himself, who was mostly a handshake and a nod kind of backer, but nonetheless, that's pretty good support. And then, not inconsequential, there were the major scientific entities, such as the American National Geographic Society and the American Museum of Natural History, who stood to benefit from scientific knowledge and spoils, as it were, to be able to say that they were behind some of this. So it meant that these explorers had to spend not only a great deal of time planning, but fundraising. And so that's a big part of it. I'm really glad you brought that up, because it was incredibly costly.
Well, and I should think that just because someone has sort of the mindset and skills and experience to be a good explorer, that doesn't necessarily translate into being able, when it came to this other matter of being able to raise funds and speak persuasively to those with deeper pockets. And it sounds like Mr. Wellman was somebody who had gifts that sort of covered the board.
Absolutely. So, and I would say he was better than, the book deals with Wellman than the Norwegian Roald Amundsen and Umberto Nobile, the Italian. And I would say of the three, Wellman was probably the most persuasive in that regard, partly because he was a writer who, made his living telling stories and covering events. And so he was also really well positioned, because the plan was that Wellman was going to be the guy telling the stories, potentially, you know, posting in real time with telegraph, with wireless telegraphy, and then certainly writing about these expeditions after the fact if he made it home. And so you had a double-edged sword, and Wellman was really charismatic, and so he was able to kind of move seamlessly in a chameleon-like way between the world of Polar Explorer and the world of, you know, impresario or showman.
We're speaking with Buddy Levy in a follow-up conversation about his fascinating book, Realm of Ice and Sky, Triumph, Tragedy, and History's Greatest Arctic Rescue. The book chronicles several intriguing attempts to reach the North Pole via the air, either through the use of an airship or dirigible, or by means of an aeroplane. And it was thought by some of these explorers that this was actually going to be the safest and most effective way to reach the North Pole. I thought it would be interesting, Mr. Levy, to spend a few minutes talking about this sort of vehicle called the airship and its earliest days. I mean, predating the events that we are talking about in your book, which occur primarily in the early 20th century. Tell us what you know about when and where and under what circumstances the airship was invented, designed, and a little bit about its earliest history.
Sure. Yeah, it's really interesting. So it's important to remember that it must be, 50 to 75 years, maybe longer. The air balloon, the hot air balloon, is the predecessor of the airship. And so in France primarily, but in Europe widely, the hot air balloon was a big deal. It was a spectacle. And there were these races that were run by this magnate, this captain of industry in France, who had they weren't really so much races as they were time aloft competitions around in Paris. And Walter Wellman and lots of other journalists had been fascinated by these air balloon events. And so, and even as late as the late 1800s, a Swedish man named S.A. Solomon attempted to fly an air balloon to the North Pole from nearly the same place that Wellman and the others eventually tried. And he flew off and was never seen again. But this is sort of what sparked the idea of maybe if we put a motor on these things. But it was sort of happening simultaneously in France and in Germany, where the airship was being developed in very rudimentary stages and not able to fly very far, but I will say it was flying farther than airplanes were flying. And so while the airplanes were being flown, hundreds of feet, the airships in Europe were being flown, dozens of miles. And so into this context arrives Walter Wellman. And these craft were kind of, they were fascinating because air balloons were made of primarily of silk in the envelope, right? So you've got, they understood that hydrogen gas, which is about 14 times lighter than air, created, if enough bulk of it in cubic feet was put into an envelope or air balloon or a balloon, you have loft, right? And so it evolved that, well, if you put a motor on this, you could actually navigate it, because air balloons were the mercy of the winds. So in France primarily, and this is where Wellman went to have his Airship America initially built, the best designers had congregated. And you've got really interesting, these ships had two layers of cotton and one of silk overlaid with three coatings of rubber, and then they're inflated with, this aircraft was inflated with something like 274,000 cubic feet of flammable hydrogen. And they were only able to go about 12 to 15 miles per hour in no wind. But this, as I said, was providing greater mobility and distance navigation than the airplane at the time. So that's kind of the backdrop in which Wellman decides, hey, the airship's going to be the way to go here if we're going to try to fly to the North Pole.
Hmm. I love the detail with which you describe his journey to Paris by luxury steamer. And you tell us that it was a concession to his wife, Laura, that he did not make this trip alone. Explain to our listeners who accompanied him to the beautiful city of Paris.
Well, so Arctic explorers are usually gone for years at a time, right? And Wellman already had been. And so he's got, Wellman has a wife, Laura Wellman, and a whole passel of daughters, eventually five, all named with R's. And so as a concession, what I mean by that is, so he's having to convince his spouse, like, okay, I'm going to be gone again for an undetermined period of time. And so I better at least take my wife and a couple of my older daughters to Paris, the beautiful city of lights, so that to appease their, disgruntlement at my the fact that I'm always gone. And, a lot of explorers didn't even go that far. They just said, honey, I'm gone. And then, 2 years, 3 years later, maybe they come home. So, Wellman was he was trying to keep things covered at on the home front.
So explain exactly what he was trying to accomplish in the city of Paris with the creation of this new airship, which would be called the America. I mean, and what role did he play in that?
Yeah, Wellman was so involved in every aspect of these expeditions, including, so he had hired a French airship designer named Godard, I think is how you pronounce it. And, but Wellman was really involved in the design process himself. And so he had specifications. Now, I say that the airship was 185 feet long when he's ultimately flying, but the initial one was a little smaller, about 163 feet. And so Wellman is involved in every aspect. I mean, so his scientist, even though he's quite remarkable in the sense that he's a self-taught guy who has very little formal schooling, and, by the time we meet him, he's a famous journalist who also is dabbling in really complex science and, innovative airship design. So he's got all sorts of ideas for how to, remember, this is all untested. So he's got all sorts of ideas on how to configure this airship to best make it work. And so he's overseeing the French designer in terms of things like, the horsepower of the engine, which, by the way, 75, it's like your local putt-putt motor on a lake, on an outboard boat. But he had some wild ideas, he and this other guy named Melvin Banneman, who he hired, and Felix Reisenberg. But he had these ideas about keeping the airship relatively close to the polar surface, because there's an issue of something called pressure height. And when the airship is fully inflated, if it rises too fast, too quickly, and it exceeds what's called pressure height, which is where the envelope is filled with hydrogen completely, there can be problems such as explosions by the hydrogen expanding relative to the air around it. So, Wellman designed this idea. One was called an equilibrator, which is like a, they called it like the giant sausage or snake, which was about 1,000 foot nearly, ultimately, coiled cable filled with eventually his food. They were able to stuff the food in there, hundreds of pounds of it. And this cable, he called it retrievable ballast. And so the cable could be let down, and then it had kind of grappling hook metal spikes on the end to keep it. The theory was to keep it tethered to the earth, dragging along, so that you could maintain your elevation, which was pretty novel, though such things had been used in hot air balloons. And then he had another one called the Ritard d'Atour, and he, in a nod to the French designers, he used the French word, which is it was Ritard d'Atour, so it was basically a break, and that had a really significant hook on the end, and the plan was to be able to use that if you were able to hover and potentially in low wind, have that hook grab onto an ice chunk or iceberg, and you could then potentially stay in one place hovering. Because these craft were kind of tricky to land.
Hmm. We should mention that these two innovations that you are talking about right now, the Equilibrator and the Ritardateur, these were part of a process of refitting the America. That is, going literally and figuratively back to the drawing board. Explain what had gone wrong and why it was necessary to adjust this new airship, to change it in some way, to perhaps make it a more successful craft for this upcoming expedition.
Right. So on one of his earliest trip, he had some difficulties, and I have to remind listeners that he had never formally test flown this. The America in Europe before going to Svalbard, and so he was sort of cobbling things together on the fly. After an initial sort of shakeout expedition where he was trying to see if things would work, and he ran into some problems, he went back to the drawing board in Paris, and he realized pretty quickly that he was going to need a bigger craft. So he actually, I mean, it's kind of remarkable. He had the airship, you know, dismantled, taken back to France, you know, deflated and cut in half. And then they added 20 feet of fabric to the center of it and sewed it back together. And then the rationale here was that it would be able to hold more hydrogen gas, have greater lift, and have greater, which would allow him to put on a larger, so the control car is this sort of box that rides underneath the bottom of the airship, and it is where the men, navigator, the engineer are, you know, they are housed in this control car, which is kind of an open air situation, very breezy and cold. But he had built a bigger, better control car too. So all of this was in lieu of a kind of test flight. He sort of decided, okay, we're going to need to have bigger payload too, because he was going to, in the event of a ice landing, unintentional ice landing, he was going to need to bring thousands of pounds of food for a year or more on the ice should they, you know, be imperiled on the ice. And so all of these were, it was kind of a metamorphosis. Wellman was always thinking, tinkering, and trying to figure out what was the next thing needed. And I don't know if I mentioned the gasoline dogs or the soma machines that he attempted to use. But, you know, he tried all sorts of things. He was willing to give a try to these kind of like precursor of the what we now know as the snowmobile or snowcat. And even brought those in ships.
Hmm.
And they didn't work very well, but he was willing to try.
Sure. He was certainly a cutting-edge, innovative thinker. And I appreciate the detail with which you describe all this, because, I mean, if in the shorthand of history, I mean, if we're just going to be reading a paragraph-long summary of who Wellman was and what he tried to do and what he failed to accomplish, I mean, one might easily get the idea that he was just a dreamer, a grandiose dreamer with delusions of grandeur and so on. And maybe that was part of who he was, but you describe someone who is being incredibly meticulous and relentless in his quest to try to achieve this goal. And even when it came to brand new technology and even emerging, evolving technology, Wellman was not afraid to try to do whatever it was going to take to allow him to succeed in this extraordinary venture.
Yeah, that's a really great observation. And, you know, not only that, he was so multifaceted. He was attempting to, and did, in fact, set up the first wireless Stellarev station in Svalbard, in the Arctic, and sent the first dispatch from the Arctic by wireless to none other than Theodore Roosevelt. And so he was really on the cutting edge of real-time journalism as well. And, you know, as early as 1893, he predicted that aerial airships will solve the mystery of the North Pole and the polar seas. And so he had been thinking about this, you know, for a decade or so before I imagine him staying up late at night with these ideas and visions and plans in his head that many people are saying are crazy. But he stuck to it. And history kind of looked at him as an Arctic exploration footnote. So in part, I'm trying to wrest him from obscurity, and I view his efforts as pioneering rather than failures.
Very good. By the way, I can't neglect to mention something that leapt out for me on the page, and that was one of his collaborators in this redesign of the airship that you mentioned already, someone by the name of Melvin Vanneman. I happen to be an opera person, so it leapt out at me when you tell us that, among other things, he toured the United States as an opera singer for some years, and had some other talents as well. And it kind of speaks to something that we sometimes forget about in this age of specialization, that there were people like Melvin Vanneman dabbling in this and dabbling in that, and Renaissance men in more ways than one.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I love Mel. You know, there should be a book about Melvin Vanneman. The guy, I mean, you know, Wellman ends up kind of, he's lucky to find him and has learned that there's this very interesting young man in Paris who's trying to buy his own airship to do, and I think he actually procured one, to do aerial photography. So Melvin Vanneman is an American guy but he was quite a wanderer and had traveled overseas in Australia and New Zealand. And he had been, as you say, he was trained in music and had traveled as an opera singer. And he was known to be, as they were up in Svalbard working around the craft, he would be singing operas as they went, you know. But his other real passion was aerial photography. And so the guy, and he was known for being fearless in climbing really high things, including like flagpoles, buildings, and getting onto hot air balloons to shoot aerial photography for different organizations and states and countries. So he'd worked in the South Pacific and Australia and New Zealand. And the guy was just, as you say, he was a Renaissance man. And, you know, because there's so many other big characters in this book, we spend a good deal of time with Vanneman, but not enough. And I must admit, I need to go back and really learn more about the guy because he was fascinating.
Buddy Levy, the author of Realm of Ice and Sky, Triumph, Tragedy, and History's Greatest Arctic Rescue, published by St. Martin's Press. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I look forward to speaking with two faculty colleagues from Carthage about a recent study tour to the nation of Cuba. And on Wednesday, Dr. Lynn Akey, the Chancellor of the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, is my guest. Kaylin Palomares makes her monthly Morning Show visit on Thursday, and on Friday, a Valentine's special with podcast host Jill Roth. Today is going to be a mostly sunny day, and we are headed for a high of 32 degrees. Does look like it's going to be an eventful week with a very good chance of snow developing late Tuesday and into Wednesday. This is WGTDHD, Kenosha's receiver.